Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast. Three women, one podcast, and a whole load of badass. With me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and no, Emma Sexton. She's in Australia. It's all right for some. This week, we speak to Katie Ghosh of Women's AIDS about domestic violence and why it's on the rise. We meet a man who was inspired by the death of his son to create a truly moving charity. And we round up the baddest of badasses from 2018.
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
So in 2017, stats from Women's AIDS show that 139 women murdered by men were overkilled. And so overkill is when extreme violence is used. It's when men are using more force than is necessary to actually kill someone. They're killing and beyond. On the line now, we've got Katie Ghosh, the chief executive of Women's AIDS, to talk to us really about why these stats are still happening. Katie, I really thought with all the conversation that we've had over the past few years about domestic violence, about violence against women and girls, that perhaps we would not be seeing this extreme level of anger and aggression. And yet it's still there. What's going on?
It is still there. And it's horrifying, isn't it, when we look at the statistics. And the reason that Women's AID and Karen Ingalls-Smith produced the femicide census is exactly to put the facts and the figures out there. And you've just mentioned one of the major findings from this year's census, which is around 40-42% of the cases showing overkilling, this extreme level of violence, more than is necessary to kill somebody. And the reason we wanted to include that and to highlight that is it does say something about the extreme gratuitous nature of violence that some abusive partners or perpetrators will go to. And also we really want to challenge some of the media reports about this. You know, it's a crime of passion, it's a moment of madness, that the deliberate intention and sometimes the desecration and the despoiling of the body, horrific stuff to think about, but we have to challenge some of these myths. So, yes, it's been amazing, new waves of feminism, really good challenges, but then we do have to look at the rates of femicide and question what's happening.
One of the things that really shocked me was when we looked at the stats, if you took out women who had been killed in terror attacks, when you just looked at the other deaths, the majority of those women had been killed either by a current or former partner.
Yes, and the reason, again, it's so important to get this information out there is we're still finding that in not all cases are the police taking it seriously when a woman goes to them when the relationship has come to an end. Mm-hmm. And that level of post-separation abuse within the first month and the year and the number of femicides that happen then, the number of killings of women by men that happen after the relationship has come to an end. And we thought that was really important aspect of the findings to highlight, and it's why it's so important that the police take seriously. And it may be that there hasn't been physical abuse, but that there's been a very coercive and controlling behaviour. When that relationship comes to an end, what we sometimes see is the abusive partner wanting even more to exert control over her, and in some situations exerting control over her means taking the ultimate control, which is taking her life.
Katie, one of the things that has shocked me this week actually is, I was saying earlier on the show that whenever I get in a cab I end up having a conversation about feminism and what does it mean, And I was talking to a cab driver actually about coercive control. And he was saying, well, I don't know what it is, because people say, give me examples of it, and it just seems like normal behaviour. And the example he gave was, you know, sometimes I've got 50 quid in my pocket and my wife says, hang on, what's happened to that 50 quid? And I've spent it in the bookies, or I've been out for a drink with my mate, and I just think that's going to be a difficult conversation to have. So I just say, what do you mean 50 quid? I've never had 50 quid. You're being ridiculous. I've never had it. Is that kind of behaviour, should we be on the lookout for that? Should we be saying to men, this is gaslighting, this is not okay? How do we get that across?
Absolutely. And I was talking to one of the helpline workers on the helpline that Women's Aid and Refuge run about this, and they were actually saying positively that there is, we do often now have a lot of callers who know what gaslighting is, or maybe have mm-hmm. a bit more information about coercive control than, say, 10 years ago. So I think mm-hmm. that's a positive. We absolutely have to talk really openly about what the signs are. So you've just given an example there of gaslighting, where you're literally trying to make the other person think they're losing their mind,
yeah.
and that their reality isn't the reality. So that's an example of gaslighting. Coercive and controlling behaviour, it can be having absolute control over the finances. It can be preventing you from seeing your friends and family. It can be controlling when you go to sleep, what you eat, even when you go to the toilet. These are real life examples of coercive and controlling behaviour, and it's so important that we bring them to life and we get across the message that domestic abuse isn't just about abuse that leaves bruises. It's also about emotional and psychological abuse as well.
Katie, one of the things that chimes with me, especially about this time of the year, and it's going to sound like an odd tangent, but a lot of the soaps build up to a big storyline that is connected to gaslighting and all forms of abuse that aren't just physical, you know, from your EastEnders to your Corrie to your Emmerdale. And growing up, to me, that's how I realised what abuse looked like that wasn't the physical type. Because I remember it from storylines, and I remember thinking, he's trying to make her think, he's trying to make Tracy or whoever think that she's doing this, or that he's not having an affair when he is, and when she finds out that she gets beaten for it. And so that's how I learned what was right and wrong. And I think it's the one time of year where actually families do sit down together and talk about the sorts of things they might not talk about if it wasn't presented in such a different mainstream medium. Do you think that they do play a positive role?
They play a really positive role, but, you know, provided obviously that they're done sensitively,
yes, of course,
and,
yeah.
and with good insight. And what really makes a difference is taking on board the experiences of survivors who can really bring to life what the reality is. They can make a huge difference, and whatever program it is we watch, and then talking about it. And something I found this year at Women's Aid, we commented on Love Island as well, and some of the behaviours, and we got this tremendous response. And I had younger women who we might not always be in touch with talking about how helpful it is to have a name put on something, and how that can spark you to have a conversation. So if you see perhaps it's a storyline or something in reality TV about coercive control or gaslighting, and that's giving us the language to have those conversations, the more we can get domestic abuse and abusive relationships out into the open, the better we are to help each other to tackle them, to escape from them, and to move on and recover.
Yeah. Katie, there's no way I can talk about this without somebody tweeting me to tell me that the biggest rise in domestic violence is against men. And what do you say to that?
Well, I'm not sure what they would mean by the biggest rise, but what we feel very strongly about at Women's Aid is that every single survivor of domestic abuse, men and women, should get the support that they need. 42% of our local member services have some sort of provision for men, and that's important. But coming back to the femicide census, these are gendered crimes. We have to tackle and address them as such. Otherwise, we're not going to get the right support out there. So, for example, 4 in 5 female victims of domestic homicide were killed by a partner or ex-partner. The majority of the suspects were male, so 238 out of the 239. And yet another part of the picture is the majority of victims of domestic homicides were female, but that really contrasts with the victims of non-domestic homicides, where the majority of victims are male. Mm-hmm. So you know, every survivor of domestic abuse, anyone who's in an abusive relationship, should get the support they need. But it's so important to get the facts and figures right. These are gendered crimes and we have to address them as such.
What kind of support do we need? Is this about giving support to women, to families, or actually is it about going a step back and saying we need to be looking at the support we give to men that means they're not growing up with this attitude thinking that this is in some way a part of their reality?
It's absolutely all of that. We need, you know, domestic abuse is an epidemic and we all need to be part of tackling it. Absolutely. I was with a group recently and they were doing terrific work in a school with 8, 9, 10-year-old boys, having those conversations, challenging attitudes. Most importantly, talking about what healthy relationship is. Because if your first relationship is unhealthy and abusive, you're not really going to have that benchmark. You might not realise that it's not right to be frightened of your partner. So absolutely tackling misogynistic attitudes, tackling attitudes around control in relationships are really important. But we also need everybody from the police officer, midwife, housing officers to be playing their part as well, so that they know if somebody is coming to them, how to do that listening and responding and signposting on them on to a local domestic abuse service that will be able to help them.
Do you see rates of domestic abuse rise over Christmas?
I'm always cautious about what we say about that. What we actually find is that it is after the Christmas period when things are a little bit more calming down, maybe kids are going back to school.
Money's a bit tight.
We can sometimes see a spike in the lines then. So I'm always very hesitant about saying something, you know, a figure's gone up or not. It can be a very difficult time for some survivors of domestic abuse, certainly over the Christmas period. But we need to be a little bit cautious about putting a number on it.
And Katie, for anyone who thinks they might be in a coercive relationship or is worried about their relationship, what advice would you give them?
You're not on your own. Please don't suffer in silence. We're absolutely here for you at Women's Aid. 0808 2000 247 is the National Domestic Violence Helpline that Women's Aid runs with Refuge. So please feel you can pick up the phone. Perhaps you're worried about your own relationship, you're worried about a friend or family member, we're absolutely there for you. And I think something all of us can do in our own lives as well, if somebody perhaps does open up to you, the most important thing you can do is listen and remember that the immediate thing for them might not be leaving the relationship. And it's very easy to say to someone, oh, why don't you just leave? That's the worst thing to say. Listening and letting them know you're going to be there for them, come what may, is the most important thing you can do.
Yes, Katie Gosh, Chief Executive of Women's Aid, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. If you do need any help or advice, please do check out their website, womensaid.co.uk, which has all the numbers you need to call.
The Fempire Strikes Back. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
Do you know what? We love a really heartwarming story at Christmas and somebody who has just made an incredible impact from difficult circumstances, and that is definitely our next guest. Martin Lieb is the founder of Samuel's Charity, which has been set up to supply funding for equipment on children's wards. Martin, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you doing?
Tell us a little bit about your son Samuel.
Samuel's one of those kids that you kind of knew something was a bit special about him. He was always very wanted to help other people. He was very bright-eyed. He had a great smile. He was one of those kids that you just loved being around. And he always grabbed the room. You know, he was the centre of attention and he loved to chat to everyone. He's a gorgeous kid.
And his illness and subsequent death must have been horrendous for you. What was, as a parent, what was that experience like to go through?
Watching your child when they're very ill is very hard. Feelings of helplessness, I think, are probably one of the hardest things to deal with. The role of a parent is to look after, to protect and to be there for your kids. And when you can't do that, when you're watching your children slowly fade away, it becomes very heartbreaking. It's an everyday thing that you have to try and deal with. You have to try and stay positive. But it's very hard because you're just screaming at yourself to do something, and there's nothing you can do sometimes, and especially when it's a very serious illness, and the survival rates on so many different things like cancer and tumours are particularly low sometimes, and that can be hard to deal with.
I mean, he had a particularly rare and aggressive form of cancer. Yeah. How did you know he was ill?
We first found out he was feeling tired and had a sore shoulder. So we really didn't know what it was. It was at the end of the summer in 2013 and the school holidays. And he thought, you know, he's been running around too much or he's fallen over and, you know, climbing trees. And then a few days later, he was feeling really sore. So he got rushed into hospital. They thought it was a blood clot in his shoulder. And it took a blood test. And the next day we were taken into a room with the doctors and they told us it was cancer. Complete shock. It just came out of nowhere.
How did it affect your family?
It changes everything. You know, life stops. You readjust to the worry that your child won't survive. You can't help but think that right from the beginning. Whenever you hear the word cancer, there is hope so much more now, but it's still one of those things that just stops you in your tracks in life. We pretty much moved into the hospital. So 5 days a week, I'd be there, often overnight, sharing that with his mum and his nan, and we were there all the time. And you know, I gave up my job. I started working from his bedside so I could be there all the time. You change everything to be there, because that's the very least you can do, and sometimes it's the only thing you can do is be by their side, and that's really what they need and want at the time. And being as much of as hard as it is for you, it's so much harder for them.
Yeah.
You know, and at nine when it happened to him, he understood. He didn't get the technical side of it, but he understood. He knew what he was dealing with.
How did it change him?
This happens quite a lot. I mean, I have a fair bit of contact with other parents and kids in the wards, and you hear the same stories all the time, that the kids are often, they mature very, very quickly, way beyond their years. They have to deal with their own mortality, with the daily amounts of medicine and the awful side effects that they go through. So you can see they can either fall apart and go inside themselves, or they stand up and they deal with it. And they deal with it. It's amazing the strength that they have. And often they'd be looking after you. There are plenty of times where they go, "Don't worry, Dad, it's fine. It's okay. Don't get stressed. It'll be fine. Go have a breather and you'll be okay." You know, it's your 9-year-old son looking after you when there's been a particularly bad day, and they're the ones that are having to deal with the illness.
It's amazing, actually, the strength that you have to talk about it, because I can see even now, just talking to you, that it's still, it's reliving that experience in every word.
Yeah. I think there was a point when, during his illness, I knew that there was a chance that he might die. And it's at that point that I wanted to be able to, while he was in hospital, I'd be focused about what was going on with him. So I had to kind of step away from my own worries and fears. You put that in a box and you get on with every day. And on the day or two where I wasn't there, that's when you could let it out.
Mm-hmm.
But when he died, grief is a very individual thing, and how you deal with it is different for everyone. It's almost like your personality. There are so many different emotions that make up grief, and how you deal with that is a very individual way of dealing with the thing that happened. It's not the thing that happened so much as how you are with it. And I've found that if I'm constantly addressing it and not walking away from that pain, especially I go back to the hospital wards. I was there yesterday at the wards, doing some helping out and seeing some of the staff and bringing some things for the kids. And it hurts. You relive those times time and again, but you get better at doing it. And I think that's one of the hardest things to do, but it's one of the better things you can do as a parent that's lost a child, is you deal with it and you get used to it, because every day you notice there's an empty seat. You notice that there's a present that doesn't get opened at Christmas time. But holding it off, pushing it away, mm-hmm. is with many things. If you resist it, it doesn't go anywhere. It mm-hmm. doesn't get solved. You know, there's nothing that can fix this, but there are things that you can do that you can handle it and be a lot more comfortable with it.
Yeah. Coming up, we are going to hear more from Martin and some of the incredible things that you have been doing to help yourself handle with it.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
Welcome back to Badass Women's Hour XL with me, Harriet Minter and Natalie Campbell. And we are talking to Martin Lieb, the founder of Samuel's Charity. Just an incredible story.
Mm. Listening to you, Martin, it got me thinking, how do you go from devastation and ultimately what must be a huge sense of loss to thinking, okay, well, I'm going to create a legacy out of my son's life, out of Samuel's life? So how did you set up the charity?
Well, the charity actually started while Sam was still in hospital. Mm. He was going through a particularly bad time, and the food was awful. And often kids, when they start doing chemo, have to take medications that make them very hungry. Mm. And the food was really, really bad in hospital. So he said to me, Dad, I want you to set up a charity. We need to get some nice meals for the kids in the ward.
It was his idea.
It was his idea, mm. yeah. And so we started there. So we set up a Facebook page and thought we might be able to raise £500. We can get some food and some bits and pieces for the ward, the things that are missing. You know, the things that, I mean, you spend 10, 12, 14 hours if you're not staying overnight on the ward. Yep. And if you stay overnight, you're there at the very end of the morning. You live there. Mm. And there are some basic stuff that could be really useful. So we put it out on Facebook. Mm. And it took, I don't know, a few days to raise the 500. And then it just kept going and going and going. And, you know, and it gave Sam something to focus on. There was something good that was coming from it. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about it at night and we got some things that he could present to the nurses that mm. would raise money for. And mm-hmm. it was a little bit cathartic. There was something positive coming from what was going on. Mm. But it didn't really hit me as much until afterwards, until he'd gone, because I didn't know if I was going to carry on with it. Mm. You don't really plan at that point.
And where's the charity now? What happened after his death? What made you decide to keep it going?
I think it was a personal desire first, because it was a link to him. It was something that he began, and it's something that I get to talk about him. Mm. You get to have that feeling of still doing something together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And afterwards, I felt, even though it was very hard going back to the hospital, to the wards, it felt like, again, it was something positive was coming from it. Mm. I was able to be able to feel like I wasn't quite so powerless, quite so useless in the face of what happened to Sam, that we could do something, we could carry on helping, even in a small way. And it did help, you know, and the more the people on the wards, the parents, the nurses, the play specialists, who are a hugely integral part as well, which gets so often missed. They'd spend so much time with the kids and look after them. When they kept saying, yes, this is good, this is helping, mm. this is the sort of thing that we need, you carried on doing it. And at each step it was, I've never been here before. What's going to happen next? Do I just stop now? Is it really helping? Mm. And you know, people tell you, yes, that could be good. Could you do this? Mm. Could you help us here?
What sort of things have you been buying? What sort of things has the charity been providing?
The first thing was transforming the food at the hospital where he was. That took about a year and a half, but we completely changed it from indistinguishable, disgusting food,
yep.
To meals that were planned, that they could order, that were decent quality, that were served, which was fantastic. We got free Wi-Fi for all the kids' wards, because before that there was very poor quality
and expensive.
Oh my god, unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And McDonald's had it free and children's wards were charging you. It was disgusting. So I had a bit of a chat with an IT manager, took him around the wards and said, do you think this is okay? Mm-hmm. And this was just before Christmas. And surprisingly, it got changed quickly. And the company that did the Wi-Fi made it free. Mm-hmm. And that absolutely transformed the ward, because now the kids could get online, they could Skype, they could play games, they could watch TV. It was one of the biggest things that we could give. And equipment wise, I think, on especially on the wards where kids stay a lot, they have lots of injections for all different things, from having just bloods taken for giving medicine all the way through to chemo and all sorts. So injections can be very hard, and when you've been in hospital a long time, your veins become very hard to find. So there's a machine called an AccuVein, and it's just a light that shines on your skin and it shows where the veins are, so you can do a injection first time every time. So much less pain. And if you're watching a program on a tablet or TV or DVD player and they do the blood, sometimes they don't even notice it's been done. It's a huge thing. It's one of the biggest issues kids have in hospital, is having injections and having bloods and having medicines. I mean, Sam had to have an injection twice a day for blood clots, and he used to scream. I mean, he used to absolutely scream because of it. It hurt so much. This would have helped, but for the day-to-day things, for having taking the fear away from injections, that in itself is, that's one of the few things you can do as a parent when you're looking after a kid in hospital, is take away some of that pain. And to be able to do it, and to be able to do it across wards, it's one of the biggest things our charity's done.
How many children's hospitals are out there that need, you know, this level of support in terms of changing food? And because it's not, there's not one in every city per se.
I can't quantify that. I've had to be very careful and not go to lots of hospitals because they'd all ask.
Yeah.
I mean, in my experience, we started at St George's Hospital in Tooting in London, which is where Sam was for the most of the time, for almost 5 months. And their wards really did need some support. There are other hospitals that there's a couple of other hospitals that we help because people have contacted us from there. St Peter's in there's St Peter's, which is in Brixton. There is Bath Royal United Hospital, and King's College as well. So King's College, Brixton, St Peter's over in Chertsey. The thing with the children's wards is that you can have one ward that's very funded by maybe somebody quite famous or a charity that's had that's looked after that ward, but down the corridor there can be another ward that can't afford pens and paper. And it's, you know, the kids are in there for, sometimes they're in there for a couple of days, sometimes in there for weeks or months, and they've got nothing to do, and there's no way of distracting them from keeping them positive, giving them something to look forward to. Because when you wake up and the only thing you know you're going to do is have injections, is have medicine, know that medicine's going to make your stomach churn, make you throw up. Sometimes the pain is awful, what they have to go through. They've got nothing to look forward to in that day. It can be, you know, for an adult that must be awful to deal with and depressing, but for kids, they go into themselves, they switch off, it becomes very hard to engage with them and for medicine and treatment to even work. So having something that can keep them engaged, to keep them in contact with their friends, with their family, it's a huge thing.
Are you also campaigning for just more funding and policy change around this? Because listening to you, in my mind, I'm like, well, it should just be statutory that the wards are well funded. And I know it's like hospitals are governed by the primary care trusts that are around them. But actually, you know, the Department of Health and Social Care can mandate some level of spend.
They can. Each hospital as a trust has a certain amount of funding that they get. Quite often they're in a negative.
Right.
To millions. They have to put the funding that they have to the most crucial areas, which will be for the worst areas in the hospital or the most urgent care, or what gives it the most return on their pound, because it is obviously a business decision when they're dealing with where they spend the money. Those sort of things that we help with are very low down. It's realistically charities that deal with this, or parents that want to give back to the wards that have looked after them. Some of the wards are in such poor condition. They haven't been updated or redone in nigh on 2 decades, and they're in awful condition. And some of them have no heaters in winter, no air conditioning in summer. I mean, these are kids that are neutropenic, that are burn victims that are, it's awful. And to say we'd like something like some higher level things, like having a chef on the ward with a kitchen there, means that they'd have to completely tear the whole building down, rebuild it, in billions for a large hospital. They just don't have the funding to do that.
But the common sense that good nourishing food heals people, that, you know, if we're thinking about preventative, just good sense,
absolutely,
then there must be ways and means.
We put pressure on. We are looking at doing, and we've been talking to do a partnership where we go around hospitals to go in and help make that transformation, like we did at St George's, because we got a lot of help from the staff and the hospital to do that. That wasn't us in any, we wouldn't be able to do that. You can bring a message and you can put pressure on. But again, there's a cost issue. And of course, when you're dealing with food, there is they go out to tender. And they'll have a tender for 5 to 10 years. Okay. And they generally go for the lowest priced one. Mm. And when you go for the lowest priced tender, guess what you get?
Yeah.
You get rubbish food. Mm. Some of them are very good. But from my experience in the places I've been, the food wasn't great quality. It was okay for adults that were there for a few days, a week, 2 weeks. But when you're there long term and it's the same stuff, we used to play a game. Was, can you guess what the food is by looking at it? It didn't generally win.
Yeah.
It's not great. Mm. But you're right. If the food quality was better, you know, the correlation between having good food and when you're sick, you can't eat much anyway. Yeah. So the what you get is really, really important.
Mm. Martin, how much has Samuel's charity raised now?
We've raised just under £200,000, which is, it's huge. We never thought we'd ever be there.
That is incredible.
But to put it into perspective, an Accuvain costs £4,000.
Yeah.
Redecorating a whole ward is £150,000, and that's just taking away what's there, and that's not all the equipment and the bedding. That's just redecorating and putting some new bits of furniture in and a few other bits and pieces. That's not the cost of doing things is high. It is, and that's why I'm pushing to grow the charity, because it would be so easy to go to lots of other hospitals and say, "Do you have any? You know, any of the kids' wards need any help?"
Yeah.
I'd probably get a yes most of the places from varying degrees, because some of them have charities, but you know, they'd never say no to more help, and there are so many things that need to be done.
Yeah. If people want to find out more about it or donate to it, give us all the details. Where should they be looking?
You can go to samuelscharity.co.uk. You find us there, or on Facebook. We've got Samuel's Charity as the page.
And one of the things you've done to kind of raise the profile and bring some people in is you have a song called Podcast All Stars, The Sounds of Christmas. All money raised from it is going to Samuel's charity. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
I was on a podcast a few weeks ago, The Modern Man, with Ollie Mann, and they were doing a challenge that started early on in the series to try and get a song into the charts for Christmas. And it was never thought to be really serious, but actually the guy Ollie Pert that did a great job and had it written and got loads of people from other podcasts to sing it. We didn't make it into the top 40, but oh my god, we were for the week before, because it was only released on the 14th.
Yeah,
it was really good. We got up to in the top 10 on the Amazon and Google Play charts. We're in the top 30 on the iTunes. And it sounds good. And those guys were fantastic. They were really, really good. They did it all in such a short time. And it's always in my head. It's been playing for the last week.
We are definitely going to be hearing a little bit of that. Martin Lee, founder of Samuel's Charity, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It's been incredible listening to you. And you have done incredible, incredible work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Fempire strikes back. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
We're going to finish with our top three badass women of the year each. You might know, most weeks we do a kind of badass of the week. We've got to pick just three for the year. I found this really tough and I feel like we're going to get it wrong in a million levels. But Nat, do you want to go first?
A guest that, and she'll stay with me, Taban Suresh, founder of the Lotus Project, is supporting women in refugee camps to learn boxing and a whole host of other things that's going to change the trajectory of their lives. Theresa May, because anyone that can go up against intense scrutiny day after day after day, regardless of what it is that she's going up against, just for me is just full-on badass. Michelle Obama, for all of the reasons we've just said, I think 2019 is going to be her year.
Oh, okay, there's a good pick. I like all those three. Good pick. So my three, Christine Blasey Ford. Mm-hmm. So Christine Blasey Ford was the woman who stood up and said, no, your pick, Donald Trump, your pick for the Supreme Court is a man who raped me when I was 19, and that is not okay. And she debated and pushed and called for Kavanaugh, who was being put up for the Supreme Court, to be held to account. She didn't have to do that. She'd kept quiet the whole time. But when she saw that this was a man who was going to be put in front of, in charge of women's rights, she said, no, it's not okay. Mm. And she waived her anonymity and she stood and argued. And in the end, he was still appointed to the Supreme Court. Brett Kavanaugh still appointed to the Supreme Court. And she has now had to move several times. She's faced death threats. She's gained nothing from this, but she did it for other women. Mm. The US gymnasts, for the same reason, for standing up and calling out Larry Nassar, the coach and doctor who had been abusing hundreds of them throughout his career. And every single one of them stood up on the stand in court and spoke about what he had done. And these are women with big profiles whose careers could be shattered from it. And they all did it. And finally, my final pick, Louisa O'Malley, friend of the show. We love her. Mm-hmm. Her mother died and she turned her mother's horrendous cancer story into a campaign for better end-of-life treatment for everyone, into a campaign for better care, into a campaign to look at how the NHS treats cannabis use. She pushed and made an incredible, brilliant comedy show out of something that was truly traumatic. And for that, she has my absolute admiration.
And they've raised just under £40,000, which they've been using to support people in hospices. And she said over Christmas, just taxis backwards and forwards to see family members. So she, yeah, so badass.
Some brilliant, brilliant women there. We've been so lucky to be able to talk about them on the show. We will be back in 2019, but we're going to have a little break over Christmas.
A little lie down.
But don't worry, there'll be brilliance here on Talk Radio next Saturday if you want to listen to it. If you want to come and talk to us, you can find me at Harriet Minter, Nat.
At Nat D. Campbell.
We're here at Badass Women's Hour HR. We'll see you in 2019. 1, 2, 3, 4! This has been the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton. If you want to hear more from us, you can come follow us on social media at Badass Women's Hour HR, or leave us a review and tell us how much you love us. We really need to feel the love. 5 stars should do it.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.